So we've been together now for, I guess, a day and a half or something like that, engaging in this practice of paying attention, meeting our experience. And we can sometimes find that what starts to stand out to us is the way we experience our body. And perhaps what it might be that our body has to offer to us is very much an essential part of this practice. Can I just check volume, clarity? It's okay? Good. In many ways, the whole sense of the meditation begins with our recognition of the fact that we have a body, that we are embodied creatures, we could say. This life, it seems, comes with a body, has a body, is a body, starts with one of these, and when this thing comes to an end, so does this thing we call life. So it's worth paying attention to. We've mentioned in terms of the meditation practice that we bring our attention to the body and the experience of the breathing in the body or the walking in the body as a way of coming into the present and a way of connecting with where we actually are and seeing very much how the mind leaves, departs for many places, it seems, and with sometimes alarming enthusiasm, despite whatever we might have thought we wished or intended. So this coming back to our body is a coming back to a very fundamental aspect of our experience, both as a grounding and a way of establishing ourselves right here in the living present moment, and equally as a way of coming to understand what it means to be alive in this form, for life to inhabit this body. And so body is described in the teachings referred to as the first foundation of mindfulness, the first framework in which we are asked to pay attention. And it's really the basis for all the other areas in which we equally pay attention. And we'll, over the days of the retreat, speak more about the other aspects, the other foundations, we could say, of meditation. But we start here. And it's interesting to see how this body, if we start to reflect on it, if we start to let ourselves experience it, there's something that, in a way, I've already referred to it, but it starts to maybe show itself a little bit to us. This body is in a process. And this process is moving in a very particular direction. Having been born, this body moves through a process of growing, aging, at times sickness, ultimately death. And this is the reality for us all and for all creatures, all beings, all living things. So, in terms of practice, one of the things we're engaging with here is how things actually are. Well, in fact, that's all of the things we're engaging with. But one of the aspects of how things actually are is that we are not here forever. We are not here forever. And how that particular truth and reality, or aspect of reality, how that affects us, how that drives or informs how we live, how we relate to our life. So, the fact that this body is subject to, at times, injury, illness, discomfort, distress, aging, and ultimately death, one of the things that, or one of the ways in which that affects us is that we sort of know that that's how it is, but we're not really sure we want to know. we kind of hope that maybe there's some way we can avoid that turning out to be true. You know, it's kind of funny, a little bit ironic, isn't it? We know that's how it is, and we'd kind of like, if possible, to avoid it in some way, despite the fact that we see people all around us going through these same processes of birth, aging, sickness, death. And there's this way in which we relate to life at times from a kind of a survival perspective, as if we're somehow trying to preserve this body forever, trying to preserve this life forever. And it shows up in the sense of the way we often experience a reaction to what's happening, where we want to withdraw from the experience because we feel threatened by it, or we want to push it away. We want to move it away from us. Either we withdraw or we get rid of it. And we know and we speak of this response in terms of psychological language as the flight or fight, run away or do battle response. And so one of the things we can notice is our body actually plays this out in many different ways. And the effect of that, when it's playing out unconsciously, is a lot of what we encounter here. So sometimes that flight response, that kind of wanting to close down or move away from things that are difficult, we can notice it in a way that the body just tightens and contracts. It's actually, if you see a sort of in a microscope, an amoeba, just this little sort of soft creature, single cell, and you touch it with something sharp, it sort of shrinks away. It shrinks away. And all the cells in our body aren't really all that different from just a, you know, we're a few hundred thousand billion of those little creatures all packed together in a sort of soft skin bag. And the whole body sometimes has the habit of reacting in this way. We notice the contraction, the tightness. And a lot of what we're encountering here is initially the way in which the body is impacted by the tendency of the mind to want to withdraw, to contract, to move away. And it's really painful, actually, at times, to just start to feel this. It's like it's not what we necessarily thought we came here for, to encounter the contractions in our body, the contractions in our mind. And of course, we don't just sort of pull away in that sense. We also sometimes try and puff ourselves up. You know that mechanism when one is frightened and the hairs on the back of the neck stand up, if you have some hairs there? You know? That's the body trying to make itself a little bit bigger, the way cats do. If they're frightened, you see a frightened cat, tail puffed up to twice the size. There's this way in which we puff up instinctively at a cellular level and equally psychologically in the face of a threat. So these two responses are something we start to notice here. We start to see that wishing to avoid or that tendency to want to push away, to crush, to destroy. And a lot of the way that latter pattern plays out is a certain kind of way we get into battle with what's happening. Can be what's happening in our mind, can be what's happening in the body, can be any number of different things, where somehow we take the view that this should not be happening and I am going to make it stop happening. I'm going to stop that mind doing what it does, or I'm going to sort this body out. That particular kind of way that when we do it, there's a sort of a, in the sense of I'm going to be in charge of this thing, whatever it is, and sort it out, we kind of puff up. I don't know if you can recognize that. Have a sense of what that's like for yourself. That we kind of, when we say that's wrong, that's bad, that my mind, it shouldn't be so noisy. It's like there's a certain bigness that we take on in that. And it's a way in which we're playing out a very deeply ingrained pattern, not just in the body, but in the mind. A lot of the way in which we talk to ourselves, we're either kind of trying to, in a way, squeeze ourselves down, push ourselves down, if we've made ourselves into the problem, or we're kind of doing battle with ourselves, as though we're kind of needing somehow to control this experience. And at other times, of course, we see the problem is not ourself, but something out there. And we go into battle with that. And we mostly know what happens when we do this. But there's a story that I'd like to share with you that I think says something about what actually happens when we do this. This is actually by a special request. So some of you may have heard it before. At least one person here has. But it's a transcript of a radio conversation that took place between the Canadian authorities off the coast of Newfoundland, it's this, I think, North Atlantic, and an American ship, a U.S. naval ship, which was released for publication by the Canadian Chief of Naval Operations. And it began like this, with a communication from the American ship saying, "Please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision." And the Canadians responded, "Recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision." You see what's going to happen here, don't you? The Americans, "This is the captain of a U.S. Navy ship. I say again, divert your course." Yours is in capital letters here. It's getting louder. And the Canadians respond, "No, I say again, you divert your course." And the Americans' response, this is in capital letters, which again, I think it means it's kind of loud. "This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the United States Atlantic Fleet. We are accompanied by 3 destroyers, 3 cruisers, and numerous support vessels. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. That's 15 degrees north, or countermeasures will be undertaken to ensure the safety of this ship." The Canadians respond, "This is a lighthouse. Migdalor, your call." So we look at the situation, it's kind of funny, isn't it? We maybe feel, or maybe we don't. Maybe we recognize ourselves somewhere here. So much of the pressure and the contraction that we encounter in ourselves is the sense that somehow life is not as it should be, and I have to make it get out of my way to be other than as it is. But life cannot be other than as it is any more than the lighthouse can get out of the way of the ship. The ship has to move. There are no other options apart from a collision. So how do we do with that, this experience? When things are not the way we wish them to be, at times uncomfortable, embarrassing, painful, scary, how do we handle that dimension, that experience of reality? For most of us, it's not an easy thing to encounter. It's not necessarily what we came here looking for, thinking, great, I really want to get entangled with all of that. And yet we need to see it. We need to understand what's going on here. Of course, the root of that movement of fight or flight, whichever way we notice it happening for us, the root of it is that we care. We care deeply about our well-being, about this body, heart, and mind, and that of others too, most likely, about this life, this world as well, quite probably. And so this caring comes into the expression of our life in a way that isn't necessarily aligned with wisdom, that doesn't recognize, we care about this life, but we don't fully acknowledge or recognize the way life is. And so In seeking wisdom and seeking understanding, we're seeking to find that way of seeing, of knowing, of understanding our experience in which we align with the way things actually are. And then the natural caring that we have expresses itself in a way that is in harmony with life rather than bringing us into conflict with it. So one of the things we're asked to look at is the tendency towards fear, the way we feel threatened by experiences, by things that we notice starting to arise, and we think, uh-oh, I think I better keep that down there. Or, you know, we start to feel it, and, well, it's okay if it stays this like this, but if it gets any bigger or stays too long, I don't want it. I can't handle it. I do not want the experience. And sometimes it's the busy, you know, did we ever get to a point today where we thought, if my mind doesn't shut up now, I'm going to explode? Like, I can't stand having to listen to this crazy thing any longer. Did anyone get to that point today? You wouldn't be the only if you did. Yeah, we have some some people recognizing that. The sense of that pressure of, actually, before I go there, what's interesting is despite the fact that we thought if it doesn't stop doing this, I'm going to explode, probably it didn't, and we're still here. You know, it's worth noticing that. That the fear of what was going to happen if doesn't necessarily, and in fact most often, doesn't turn out to be what happens. And the fear itself is the thing we need to look at, we need to understand. Now we can be sitting and we feel some twinge in our knee, and actually it's okay. But the thought comes up, what if it continues? I can't bear it, I can't bear it. It's a sensation in my knee. But we're saying, I can't bear it. Now, interestingly, the truth is you can bear it because it's happening and you're here. That's called bearing it. You don't have to like it, but it's happening. You haven't dissolved, exploded, been annihilated. But something in us says, I can't, when it's not true. And the reason we say I can't often is A, because it's uncomfortable and maybe I don't want to, but also because what we do very quickly and without necessarily even noticing it, is we start to project that experience into the future. It's like, it's not just that this is an uncomfortable sensation in my knee, but it's going to lead to serious damage, injury, and we imagine the ambulance arriving and we're taken off and the amputation, and, you know, and in our mind we've gone there in a moment. And because that's not really what we want for our life, we tighten up, somehow trying to make sure, because if we tighten, it feels like we can stop things happening, huh? All that happens when we tighten is we stop feeling them happening. They're still happening. They're still happening. We're just not feeling them. And part of what happens here is we're starting to feel the tightness, the contractedness, the densification that happens when we tighten to try and not feel. And as we start to feel, it actually begins to soften and open up. But sometimes along the way, that's not easy. It's scary. It's uncomfortable. And with regard to these experiences, it's really important to know and to understand, to remember that the fear is always happening right here, right now. But it takes us out of the present with a story about what is going to happen, what might happen. And, of course, we don't know what's going to happen, so anything could happen. And the mind finds some way, in a way, to scare itself. And we do this again and again. If we can notice when we start to become afraid, bring the attention back into the body, and just feel what that's like. Notice the contraction that comes with it. The, I don't want to go there. And just see, well, I'm already here. What's it like? Can I make space for this? Can I allow this experience too? And so far as we can, the fear itself simply becomes an unpleasant and sometimes an extremely unpleasant experience, but not one that actually threatens us. Fear in itself doesn't threaten us. And as we come to understand it, we can see that in fact there's something in it which is useful. Because there's a lot of energy when we want something to change or go away or avoid something. I don't often hear someone coming and saying, actually put it this way, I often, and you will have heard perhaps in the groups, those of you had and those of you haven't will have heard before, you know, people we talk about in the meditation centers, it's really hard to stay awake. We're drowsy, heavy, sleepy. It's like, oh, you know, barely keep our eyes open. Someone know this experience here? Anyone? Yeah. Okay, me too. And other times, of course, we might feel uncomfortable. It's sort of like some degree of pain, some degree of unease, some kind of, ah. And again, this is really not uncommon, something we find difficult, most of us. Probably again, you'll recognize that in yourself. Now, what I almost never hear is someone come and say, you know, I was experiencing a lot of pain and I was really sleepy. Mm-hmm. I've never, almost never heard that. Yeah? I was feeling really sleepy and it hurt a lot. No, I haven't heard that either. Something about the experience that's kind of intense and sometimes difficult brightens us. It actually calls us, in a way, to pay attention. And it can really serve us in this regard. The nature of pain, although almost universally we don't like it, is that it's giving us some information, and we need to listen to it. We need to listen to what it's saying to us. That response of fear, or the response of pushing something away, of anger, it's telling us something that's happening that we need to examine, we need to look at. And sometimes it can really help us. The experience, one of the experiences I had when traveling first in Asia that perhaps struck me, maybe shocked me the most, was to spend a little time, as I did, a few weeks working in a leprosy clinic in Calcutta, in India. And my mother's mother, my grandmother, is Bengali from Calcutta. And so I kind of have a connection to this city and this people and immense amount of beauty and joy and equally suffering and tragedy in the people of that city. But I was working just for a little while as a volunteer, completely unskilled, in a clinic where people were treating those who lived on the streets with no money, no resources for medicine or medical support, with leprosy and other health issues. But I was, apart from being deeply touched by these people and what was happening, I was incredibly actually shocked to discover that what I thought the problem with leprosy to be was completely wrong. That, you know, we have this association with leprosy that it's this horrible disease that makes parts of your body fall off. Actually, it's not. This is what I was told, and I've since had confirmed by other sort of medical people. Leprosy doesn't cause the disfigurements that we see, the amputate or the loss of tissue and that. Leprosy kills the nerve tissue, so you can't feel pain. This is why it's something that afflicts the poor and the uneducated in terms of the damage it does. Because they cut themselves or burn themselves, they don't feel it. So it can be quite bad. It gets infected. They don't feel it. They don't know that you should clean this or take it and have it dressed. So they don't. And that's actually where the disease progresses from. And I was really struck to understand that for a leper, the thing that would most improve the quality of their life would be to be able to feel pain. Where does that land for us? Because sometimes I imagine we think that what could most improve the quality of my life was if I didn't have to feel it ever again. Huh? So we need to be skillful and appropriate in the territory here. I'm not suggesting that we just ignore it and say, you know, I'm going to tough it out. That's not so helpful either. Sometimes we need to make an appropriate and skillful adjustment to the pressure our body is under and sitting, or to support our body in a particular way. As someone in one of the groups was speaking of a particular bodily condition, it's a vulnerability in the back that needs support, that needs taking care of. And it's important that we listen to our bodies in that regard, that we're sensitive to them. But we're not somehow trying to make this bodily experience that includes pleasure, that includes pain. We're not trying to make it different than it is, any more than we're necessarily trying to stop our mind from it having its natural activity. But we want to understand these things, and often understanding the relationship between the busyness and activity of our mind as being related to the attempt to control our experience in order to make it easy, comfortable, pleasurable, and ensure that it isn't uncomfortable, scary, or painful. So much mental activity is to do with this. And so much of our lives, in fact. If you reflect, if you think about how much of your life up till this time, this day, has been to avoid what you're scared of. How much of what you've put your time and energy into has been to avoid that which we feel threatened by. Probably, if you like, almost everyone I've ever talked to, including me, about this, that's quite a lot, huh? And yet, I think important to just stop and let ourselves know, oh, yeah, this can actually be what drives so much of my life, of our life. Now, the reality is that we are subject to hurting ourselves, to injury, to sickness. We do need to take care not to get sunburn or wind chill. It's wind chill, not so common here, probably. No, one or two people may be experiencing it if we get too close to the air conditioning unit. But really interesting how, you know, we come in and it's a bit hot, then it's getting colder, and then it's pleasant for a little while. Then it keeps getting colder, and now it's too cold, you know. We need to put on a shawl. And then it starts to warm up, and it goes the other way. And then it gets too hot when the system goes off. There isn't really a place we find very often for very long where it's just the way we want it. But that quality of attention to notice when our mind is drawn to places where we react, to places where we contract, it's useful, it's important, because this is what allows us to see, to feel, to begin to open into that pattern, that habit, that tendency of contraction. And when we actually recognize, when we know that we are vulnerable to being touched, to being impacted by life, rather than trying to avoid that, the natural consequence and response of it is that we start to be attentive. We start to be attentive. You know, it's really interesting what happens when we take off our shoes and walk barefoot, as perhaps some of you have done, and I know I enjoy to do. You know, you have to really pay attention, because there might be a sharp thing, or there might be a, you know, a creature that could sting us, or a, you know, a stone, or a sharp thorn. So we pay attention quite naturally. We put shoes on. We don't have to think about it. We can just clump around, you know, crush the thistles, squash the insects. It doesn't matter. You know? So it's like coming back, the sensitivity that comes when we recognize that we pay attention very easily. And I probably had the most mindful walking meditation of my life before I ever heard of meditation or had any instructions for it. And I'll tell you how it happened. I was walking in the mountains in New Zealand in winter with a couple of friends, and we were doing an alpine crossing. And at one point where the route went, we had to cross a frozen lake because the place around the side of the lake, there was a lot of snow sitting above it ready to fall on top of anyone who would go there. So it wasn't safe. And the safe move was to cross the lake, the frozen lake. And it's quite well frozen, but we still had our ice axes and we were checking every step. And I was in the front. And I was checking every step for a while. And then I started to think, yeah, this ice is good. It's funny talking about ice here, huh? In summer. But anyway, that's my story. This guy says, good. I start to feel confident. I start to feel, yeah, it's all right. So then I start to put the ice axe in every two or three steps, probably every four maybe after a while. Because once you're out in the middle, it's going to be solid if it's solid at the edges. And then at one point, I was just walking along pretty much near the middle of the lake. It's probably, I don't know, 200 meters or more across, so maybe 100 meters out. Just in one moment, whoosh, I went through the ice. It just, under my feet, just put my foot on it, hadn't tested that spot, went straight through. And I landed without, you know, instinctively, I flipped the ice axe over, arms down, and my backpack, and I was sitting there, waist deep, and it's a very deep lake. The water's very cold, thinking, I won't express the exact language, I think, that came into my mind, but it was along the line of, oh, bother. And, but I didn't go all the way through. It was really lucky because I had a big pack on. If I'd gone under and we weren't roped together, hindsight tells me we should have been. I just said to my friend, just slow down. I didn't need me to say that. But I was actually able to pull myself out. It was just this one little fault in the ice. It was really hard to explain how that happened. But we walked around it. And, you know, from there back to the, because we had to keep going, it was just the same going forward as back. From there to the edge of the lake, every single step, I was completely, 100%, unwaveringly mindful, present, alert. Not sure I was that relaxed, but I was there. You know, to walk as if one's life might depend on being awake for this step. Just like that. And after we crossed, we looked on the map and worked out that probably what had happened, there was a small stream running into the lake. And it was running under the snow on the land and under the lake in the water, under the ice. And it was actually cutting, a little bit warmer, a little fault in the ice all the way out to the middle. So there was this one little crack. And I found it. And I'm pretty lucky, in a way, that it wasn't a little bit bigger. But I say that because there's that quality of, in the sense of the attention that fear gives, there's that really giving attention. But to do so in a way in which we're interested to see what's happening, rather than looking away. What happens with fear, all that energy goes into trying to get away from the experience before we've even seen what it is, before we've really allowed ourselves to look at it, to face it, to feel it, to experience it. And it's only from doing that that we can really begin to understand what's needed in any place, in any experience. So this is what I sometimes describe as a process of opening our hearts. In the meditation, we're not just training our mind to be present, to be mindful, to be steady, and endeavoring to somehow clear away all the mental activity. That's not what we're doing. In fact, we're not trying to stop the mind. You can have an operation which will do that. I don't recommend it. Really. We want to understand this process. And there's the steadying of the mind, the coming back, the grounding again and again in the breath. That's one aspect of what's happening. But at the same time, there's this process of being called on, being asked to open, to stretch beyond the sense of what it was we imagined or believed was possible for us. Because so much more is possible than we may have allowed ourselves to believe, than we may have been told by others before us. And there's another story I'd like to read. That I first heard from a, told as his own experience by an English monk, English Buddhist monk. His name is Ajahn, which means teacher, Ajahn Suchito. And I heard him give a talk the first time I met him, and since been very happy to have him as a teacher and a friend, but I'd like to share the story with you in terms of what it means to work with the difficult. I find it very helpful, and I'll read it. So when he says I, it's him that's talking, not me. He said, many years ago I had this particular pain in my right shoulder. I would sit, pain, I would think, be with the pain, that will do it. Here am I, being with the pain. Being with the pain. It's not working, you know. Maybe I need to do some yoga. That'll help. That's good. Oh no, it's back. Maybe the cushion. One cushion, two cushion, three, four. Maybe if I make them go to the left or the right, that'll help. The doctor. Doctor, could you help me? Chiropractor, osteopath. For 5 years I had this pain. I had an extremely active and ingenious mind at trying to find every possible way to wriggle out of the fact that pain hurts, and I don't like it. A very obvious truth. Yet I hadn't actually come to that, accepted what one glosses over in a few words. I don't like pain. Instead, I had acted on I don't like pain. I hadn't actually examined the experience of not liking pain. I tried to think, well, you should like pain. Pain's good for you. Or pain is bad. Make it go away. But I hadn't really looked into, I do not like. So one day, sitting in meditation, I thought, this is it, the showdown. I'm going to sit here for 5 hours, not moving, and I'm going to get over this thing. The pain, wriggle. Why did I say that? Why 5 hours? I mean, after all, this is the middle way, moderation, you know. Hours go by, 2 hours, 3 hours, 3 hours and 1 minute. And after about 4 hours, I was so sick of this pain. My mind had been through all the various circuits of be nice to it, be friendly with it, kill it. And came back to, oh God, this pain. He's a Buddhist monk. Oh God, this pain. And finally, the mind just rested. It got tired out, I guess, eventually. Ignorance does get tired out after a while and has to take a break from being ignorant. And instead of ignoring it and repressing it, actually began to open to it. Without the let's open to it and make it go away. Or let's open to it and that will take me into some kind of cosmic space. But just, oh, all right. Then I began to see the sensation throbbing away. It began to appear in my mind as a kind of glowing light, throbbing, tearing, a tearing experience. And then because of this choiceless attention to it, I began to notice, well, there's that. And then there's this terrible kind of, no, 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 feeling going on. Resistance. And with that, a whole lot of bitterness towards the body, bitterness towards pain. Oh, pain, I don't like it. It shouldn't happen to me. What did I do? I'm sitting here trying to be peaceful. Pain, go away. And this kind of moaning mind. As I contemplated my relationship to the sensation, it became clear to me that there was nothing I could do with the sensation. But I could stop beating it with my mind. I began to have this experience of deep regret for all the beatings and the kickings that this mind had imposed upon life, upon this body, upon itself, upon its thoughts, telling it to shut up, telling it to be this way, telling it to be that way. And I felt like this whole system was like some mangy dog that had never really been loved, that had just been told what to do and beaten. And in fact, this vision arose in my mind of this dog, a kind of mangy, hungry wolf, looking at me saying, "How much long are you going to keep beating me for?" I felt this sense of deep regret that there should be so much intolerance and hardness towards life. And in my mind's eye, something in me reached out to this creature and started to pat it and to say, "Please forgive me." Then this creature turned into a cartoon dog. I always think of Scooby-Doo. Anyway, turned into a cartoon dog, and we were dancing, me and the pain, me and this dog. And then the whole thing just exploded very gently, and the pain disappeared. It seemed to say, "Thank you. Finally, I've been knocking on your door for 5 years. Thank you for opening. Thank you for recognizing that the problem was, I do not like, I will not accept, I will not open to you. And once you open, the lesson has been learned. The business is finished." He was experiencing a physical pain in his shoulders in this story, yeah. But it can go for other kinds of pain. No injury. Perfectly healthy, just pain. Yeah, it happens like that sometimes. So, it's interesting when we hear a story like that, and I've read it many times, and I still find it touching. But we have to be a little careful that we sometimes think, "Oh, that's how you do it. That's how you make it go away." And of course, if we do it for that reason, it won't work. Ramdas once said, "You can't be with something in order for it to go away. Because it knows." It does. It's us. It's not something else. We think, "I'm trying to make it go away," but it's not a separate thing than the thing that's trying to make it go away. And it knows. It's like if someone, you go up to someone and they say, "I'll be really nice to you if you go away." How does that make you feel? You really know what they're saying, don't you? Saying, "I don't like you." So what happens when this starts to shift is we realize it's okay for us if it stays. It's okay if it goes. We start to make our peace with even those things that we find scary, painful, and difficult. And they can be things of the body that maybe have no obvious cause. Sometimes what we encounter in the body that's uncomfortable is both the contractions of the way the mind tries to control experience and does it through the body by contracting, and we feel the painfulness of those contractions. And sometimes we also feel pain when it's not that something's happened, but actually it's those contractions beginning to open. And sometimes that also is uncomfortable. So we can't assume, because it's uncomfortable or painful, that we know exactly what's happening, which is why we need to pay attention to it. To actually allow ourselves to soften with, around, and into the places that we may have previously felt to be somewhere we could not, or we're not willing to include. And so when we do this, the body can speak to us. It starts to let us know about the nature of this life. This changing flow of experience, sometimes pleasant, sometimes uncomfortable, sometimes enjoyable, sometimes scary. This is the flow of life. This is changing, moving, aliveness, revealing itself not in our control, not according to our preference, but nonetheless something very precious, something very immediate, if we allow ourselves to be that close to it. And what we can see is that the relationships we form, the attitudes we have with our body, tend to mirror the relationships we have to life, tend to mirror how we relate to what it means to be alive. And one of the fundamental elements of this is we tend to think we own this experience. We tend to think this life belongs to me, in the way we tend to think this body belongs to me. But you know, this body doesn't belong to you. In fact, you maybe have an important and appropriate, you know, interest in it, in the way one might have an interest in something. But if you think about it, we're not the only inhabitant, are we? In terms of what's going on in this body, it's kind of embarrassing sometimes, it's annoying sometimes, it's uncomfortable sometimes. But the truth of this body is that it's a, you know, it's like a co-housing project, a biological kibbutz. There's a whole lot of beings living in here. And if anything was ever put to a vote, we wouldn't really be in the majority, most likely. Hmm? I find it helpful to contemplate, to reflect on this. You know, our bodies are full of other creatures. Between my toes live a certain collection of sort of fungi that have been there since I was a teenager and have resisted all my attempts to relocate them. And at some point one has to say, okay, we're in this together. And actually admit also that they'll probably still be here when I'm gone. Hmm? We still negotiate about how much territory we each get, but it's pretty much this is how it is. This is a shared thing. And we don't get to have it forever. We get to use it. What happens when we look at our life, we look at our body as something we don't get or we don't have forever, but something we get to borrow? I had the opportunity, very kindly, the manager of this place, Chava, loaned me her bicycle. She has an old bicycle, and I wanted to just have a little exercise, and it's too hot to go running, which is what I like to do, so I also like to cycle, and she loaned me the bike. And when I came on the bike down from where she is, which is up and down, I discovered it has no brakes. So it is on a steep piece of hill I discovered this, and it was a little scary, but I put my feet on the shoes. Luckily I had shoes on or sandals and slowed down. And it's very interesting, that sense of actually still I'm happy she gave me this bike because it's a gift. I get to use it. I don't own it. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's not my nice bike at home. It's this bike. And bringing my bike here would have been way too much trouble. Yeah? Something about seeing this life as something we receive. It's not perfect, but we get to use it. We're sharing it with any number of creatures. We can perhaps bring an attitude that's a little different here, of appreciation, of gratitude. How fortunate we are to have this body, this heart, this mind. Remarkable thing that it is. Have you, anyone really got any idea how it works? I mean, I know biologists and all of that will tell you they have a pretty good idea, but at another level, my gosh, we don't really know how this thing works. That it works at all is for sure a miracle. So maybe we could begin to trust this body and this life more fully. Maybe we could take a little risk, as some of you have been doing, to let ourselves really be touched by what's coming to us in our experience. To start to see that we can learn even from those things which are difficult. We can grow through all experiences. And this very bodily life, when we start to trust it more fully, inhabit it more unconditionally, we start to sense quite naturally, quite directly, that it is connected to something larger. It is an expression of something greater than what we know it to be when we think with our minds about it. That there is really here in this, and the Buddha said, within this fathom-long body, it's like 6 feet in a fathom, you know, a bit less than 2 meters, 1.5 meters or so. Within this fathom-long, in fact, he didn't use the word fathom, did he? He used some measurement in Pali. I don't know what it was. Within the body of this length, all of the Dharma, all of the teaching, all of the truth is revealed. So we use this body as our vehicle, as our place to come home to again and again. And in that, this body is actually a vehicle for our liberation, for the opening of our heart, for the freeing of our mind. So let's just have a few moments quietly to finish. May we all in our practice here together and in our lives come to know this body with wisdom and kindness. May we learn to live free of fear and to trust our life's unfoldment for our own welfare and for the welfare of all beings.